Welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm Sean Delaney and I'm glad you can join me today for our weekly mixture of chat and inspiration on the topic of teaching and learning. Later on this week's programme, I'll bring you a roundtable interview with four dedicated education researchers who have just brought out their third book on educational research. But first, I return briefly to last week's guest, Dr. Padraig Hogan, who is a senior lecturer in Maynooth University. Lesson study is an approach to teacher education where many teachers collaborate on planning a lesson. One teacher teaches the lesson while the others observe. Lesson study was featured on programme 284 when I spoke to Akihiko Takahashi about it. Padraig Hogan has written about lesson study and I asked him what he thinks of it as an approach to teacher learning.
I think it has great promise. I used to think this way because when I came across lesson study in the beginning, it was called Japanese lesson study. I'm talking about maybe 15 years ago. And it looked to be a very conformist way of getting everybody doing the same thing the same way. So I wasn't very hospitable to that idea. But since then, I've seen through some of the work that colleagues have been doing, that lesson study, particularly if it's taken together with a critical, reflective attitude to one's own work, can indeed be a very promising form of practical research, professional practical research. So my view on that has changed, and I think it is very promising. And in fact, in our own, with our own students now, Maynooth, the lesson study is used as in year two of the PME course. And the students like it because it enables them to become genuinely the authors of their own work and sets them on a, if you like, a pathway which can be sort of self-sustaining afterwards and makes them fluent in discovering criteria for distinguishing between what would do a good lesson or a bad lesson. Again, the comparison with looking at maybe last Sunday's game on Tuesday, you know, reviewing it, etc., and becoming ever more literate in that territory.
And would they plan the lesson collaboratively?
Yes, yes. Of course, everybody puts their own bit into it, but they might plan four different lessons, but then say, okay, if you plan the first lesson, then I plan the second. I might have learned something from you, and by the time it comes to the third person, they might have learned something. So I think it's very good to work in teams in that way.
So how do you implement it then on such a large scale? Because you would have a lot of students.
You have to trust the students. So the teacher's role there becomes, the lecturer's role, if you like, becomes that of a monitor. And the students might show videos, you can upload videos, but you have to trust the students to do it themselves and to get good at it. But the monitoring and how the monitoring is done is very important.
And is it difficult for them to get consent to video in classrooms, for example?
It can be, but permissions are very important there. But I think there's a way around that. And I think the managerial authorities may have been approached already to see if it could be done for training purposes. You know, if you phone up your insurance company, this call may be recorded for training purposes, something along these lines. But if it were done for training purposes, the guarantees need to be given, ethical guidelines need to be followed. But I think it's possible to do it. Now, if any student or any pupil doesn't want to be part of a video class, it's very easy to leave them out. We know that now from videoing for years and years. The students themselves get very good at panning. That's why they generally don't use their own cameras. They use a tripod and maybe transition your student to work it. So you can stay out of it if you don't want to be there.
Who or what inspires you?
I'm inspired by an awful lot. People I meet, teachers that I remember who were kind, who were inspirational, whom I remember warmly. Musicians inspire me, authors inspire me, people that I meet. But could I pick out one person and say, I'll think about that. You've stumped me with that question, actually.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
No, I don't think I would have a favourite one. I'm not a good blogger. I'm late coming to the technology. I manage it all right, I work on it, but I don't blog. But, I mean, a lot of literary works ranging from, say, Tolstoy to, say, D.H. Lawrence, to Brian McMahon here. There are many people who write about education in ways which bring the drama of classroom life perceptively before the author. And I like reading books like that.
So would you say they've influenced your thinking about education?
Well, there's no doubt about it. Another one would be, say, Brian Friel in Translation, which when it opens in a classroom, you know, a learning environment which there are Nina on there and there are old-timers there, 70 years of age and more. You know, things like that. They're memorable. They're dramatic.
If you could make one change to the School of Education in Maynooth and resources were not an issue, what change would you make?
Actually, we have made a lot of changes, but while resources were still an issue, I would like to have a bigger team available to do the kind of action research work that we do with schools. We've been involved in a project called TL21, Teaching and Learning for the 21st Century. And in the beginning, Atlantic Philanthropies gave us, I think, over 10 years ago, 1.35 million. That's gone. But it enabled us to visit schools and get a research team in place. And that research team largely disappeared when the money disappeared. So there are a few of us still left there, but I would like to have the resources to be able to do that and to the schools. We're working with, I think, about 60 schools now on that. I would like these schools and the education centres that we work with to feel that they have, that they can call on us more often and in a fuller way than they can at the moment.
And what kind of a difference did that money make?
It enabled us to, as I say, we had five, I think, a team of five or six people going around working with schools, listening to school principals, visiting classrooms, getting workshops underway, and learning an awful lot about school life in the way that anthropologists might, if they were, you know.
It enables so just bringing together the work of the schools and the university.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. And it shouldn't have been separated anyway. I don't recognise a rift between theory and practice. Never did, actually. Because even though people say my background is philosophy, it's practical philosophy. Interrogating the values that are embodied in what people do in classrooms. So that's why if there's anything called theory in education, it has to be based in learning environments and bettering learning environments than that.
And what was your own route into teacher education?
I started teaching in a community stroke comprehensive school. I did a master's actually while I was there. But that school had come together as an amalgamation between an academic secondary school and a new kind of school where children from large corporation estates were. But it didn't work. Everybody was going to the same school, but they were going to different schools within the school, if I can put it that way, and they knew it. So I said, there's something deeply wrong here, I thought. So a lot of the issues, even the ones that I've talked to you about now, had their birth back there. So later, when I got the opportunity to do the doctorate, and I did that, finished it in 77, and I had a big hole in my pocket, so I had to take a job, I think it was the National Council for Educational Awards for a few years, which paid more than teaching at the time, but it enabled me to get financially independent. And then this job was advertised for Maynooth, a lecturer in the education department. I applied for that, and that was 82, and I've been in Maynooth since.
And finally, Pádraig, what, if anything, from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
There's a negative and a positive way of answering that question. The ways I was mistaught myself are a continual reminder to me of the sins that need to be avoided. And there were many, there were very many. And yet, the inspirational teachers, and there were a few, and I mentioned one there who was next door, teaching the Shakespeare, I says, do you know, this teaching could be about opening up an environment rather than just regurgitation and learning stuff off and getting slapped if you don't know it. So there's good news and bad news in that question.
And the influence of the possibilities and restrictions of school were expressed by Pádraig Hogan from Maynooth University. Now we're going to hear my conversation with four educational researchers who have now published their third book on educational research. Maureen Glenn, Mary Roach, Katrina McDonough, and Bernie Sullivan's new book is called Learning Communities and Educational Partnerships, Action Research as Transformation. I'll speak to them about the book on another occasion, but we spoke about more general matters when I met them at this year's annual conference of the Educational Studies Association of Ireland, held earlier this month in UCD. The first question I asked them was, what is school for, or what are schools for? And Mary was the first to answer.
Schools are for a multiplicity of purposes, I would imagine. In philosophy of education, we would talk about the competing purposes of education being to preserve the status quo, while the other purpose would be to innovate and enhance and improve what has gone on before. Schools are for the moral and the spiritual and the physical and the intellectual and the physical development of a child. I would say the school is for learning how to live in the world, how to live a good life, and whatever that means. And it's there to maybe inculcate the young into the culture, as I say, to stabilise the status quo in one way, but also to give them the critical and creative faculties to try and improve and to imagine, as Maxine Green says, to imagine alternatives.
Maureen, same question to you. What is school for? What are schools for?
The perfect school would embrace the whole idea of holism, looking at the whole child, looking at the whole world, looking at the connections. Holism in terms of connections, because I really believe it's something that we're losing, and we can see symptoms of it all over the world. So I think that whole idea of connection between the student and other students, between the student and the teacher, between the student and the world outside, the world of nature, the world, the community outside. And then that whole idea also of connecting up all the different subjects. You know, we've had kind of ham-fisted efforts at it over the last few years. You know, we've had, you know, policies on literacy and numeracy, and now we have STEM, and, you know, they go on kind of clunking things together, whereas surely everything feeds into everything else. And so that's what I believe school should be about.
And when you say we're losing it over the last number of years, what are we losing?
I think we're losing our sense of connection with one another and with our environment and with people.
Katrina.
I suppose my focus, I have done a lot of teaching with children with special education needs, so my focus is often on enabling young people to become learners in their own right, learning about the world for themselves, learning how to critique what's going on. But the most important part of this is it's not something they do on their own. They all learn from one another and with one another. So in my view, the ideal school is about learning to expand yourself as best you can, reaching as much of your potential as you can, although we are very limited in what we can do as individuals. We probably have far more potential than we'll ever realise, and to learn to respect and learn from and with one another.
And Bernie?
I would see school as a place where children are first initiated into social activities and where they kind of learn to be members of society, where they learn to communicate with one another, interact with one another in a respectful way, and where they begin their journey of lifelong learning. I think also it's where maybe they learn about possibilities. You know, to a young child, everything is possible. I can be anything I want. And I think that then should be encouraged all the way through, that they should have this idea, you know, I can, you know, be whatever I want in life. There are no limits to what I can do. And I think, you know, schools should encourage that as much as possible.
I came to you last with that question, so I'm going to start with you for the next question, Bernie. Who or what inspires you?
My three colleagues here inspire me very much, I have to say. Also, people along my life, I suppose maybe Jean McNiff was an inspiration to me when I first met her, because it was she kind of inspired me to begin my studies first for my master's and my PhD. I'm inspired by a lot of the reading I do. People like Maxine Green, Stephen Ball, Brookfield, all of the writings that I engage with, they inspire me. As do some of the philosophers like John O'Donoghue, and that I would be inspired by those, and Martin Buber and people like that. And I suppose children in a way inspire me too, because, you know, their tendency to surprise you, you know, when you least expect it, I think can be inspiring also.
Thanks, Bernie. Katrina?
At the moment, I'm involved with a lot of practitioner researchers globally. So I'm inspired by the work that's going on in so many different countries. That's so inspirational and so amazing. There's one lady in India who has brought about self-confidence for children in a country where females are very often looked at in a different way than we might in the Western world. And she's been commissioned by the government to put her practitioner research that she did in her own classroom available throughout the country at the moment, and been supported in that, and been given opportunities to do TED Talks. So when I see these little pieces of research growing and influencing so many people. She hasn't mandated anybody to do anything, but her influence is so important around the world. I would see others in Africa and Australia, South America, North America, and across Europe who are coming up with great ideas, and they are just, the influence of them around the world is amazing. Like Bernie, children. I just am totally inspired by them. I am amazed at how much they know, how quickly they develop, and how little opportunity I had as a teacher to appreciate that. Now that I'm not so often in the classroom, I can appreciate that more.
Maureen.
You know what I find inspirational is kindness and empathy. I think they're two huge ingredients, maybe for life, but particularly in the classroom. And I love when I see examples of it, especially when in the unexpected situation, you know, say kids going mad or acting up on their teacher, and they somehow find the right humorous note to kind of turn the thing around and to be gentle and to be kind. I suppose I'm drawing really on Buber's idea, you know, that I, it and I, thou, you know, the I, thou, when you're totally aware and present with whoever it is, you know, you're talking to, which of course is an ideal situation. Yeah.
Mary.
I'm really inspired, like Bernie, with my three colleagues here. I'm also, at a personal level, very inspired by my own parents, because I'm one of a very large family. I'm lucky enough to have both my parents still alive. And I'm very inspired by how hard they worked and their values around how important it was to have an education. Not so much how important it was to have a good job, but to have a good education and to be open, to be wholehearted, like Julie would say, to be intellectually responsible. So that came from them, and a love of reading also came from both of them. And I'm inspired by colleagues, both at my college level and at my school level, who give above and beyond 125% and stay behind and do work that's never acknowledged publicly, perhaps. So I'm inspired by that. And they're often the people that Maureen talk about, the empathetic, generous, kind people. I'm inspired by Maxine Green. I know she's dead now, but she lived quite a long life and she kept on insisting right up to the end that she was not finished. I think that, and I know my own students have been hugely inspired by that. And there are individuals, again, it comes back to that giving nature and that enthusiasm. I think passion and enthusiasm and a sense of authenticity, that inspires me.
I'll start with you for the next question, Maureen. Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
The one that springs to mind when you ask the question is Parker J. Palmer. I just love his work. And it's kind of about, he talks about spirituality in education. But again, it's drawing that on that whole idea of connectedness and being aware of the whole of the other and where we are in our world.
Bernie?
Well, like Maureen, I like Parker J. Palmer as well, and Dewey, because when you think of it, it is so long ago since he had those empowering ideas, you know, about wholeheartedness and open-mindedness. You know, think that he had those ideas how many years ago now? Over 100 years ago, and that some people still haven't got to grips with those ideas and how empowering they can be. And of course, Freire, you know, I was really you know, impressed with Freire's ideas, and especially the value he had for the underprivileged, you know, and how he kind of fought for them all his life, you know, and to have them treated as equals. And I suppose he was the first person that inspired me to see that the teacher isn't up there and the students down there, you know, that it's an equality, really, and a blending of teaching and learning.
Mary?
I would say Maxine Green. I think I have everything she ever wrote. I was just so blown away when I was introduced to her. I also remember stumbling upon three particular books that really resonated with me prior even to doing a master's. One was Teacher by Sylvia Ashton Warner, which I just was fired up and wanted to try out her organic vocabulary. I remember trying that out in class, which she based on with Maori children. I was also really, really taken with a book called An Experiment in Education by Sybil Marshall. It was a post-war situation, or during the war situation, when there was rationing of paper and what that lady managed to do. Again, a holistic approach or a thematic approach. She took a piece of, I think it was Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, and she did maths, music, drama, PE, dance, needlework, English, poetry, everything, all based on the pastorals. I just thought that was amazing because I'd never been exposed to anything like that. And then the other one was, and it links in with Katrina's work, Jean Auger's book, This Book Doesn't Make Sense, 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 Each Time Spelt Incorrectly, a teacher who had 3, if not 4, children with dyslexia in her own family, and how blown away she was by seeing must try harder, and she knew the effort that had gone in. So each one of those gave me a different sense, even prior to doing formal reading, and they've stuck with me.
Thanks, Mary. And Katrina?
I'm going to mention Froebel, because I think there are a lot of philosophers around education who started with the practice and come up with their own thinking about how education works, following on the questions that you've just asked us here today. And what I see about his work is there's a Froebel College in Ireland, and the thinking that he had behind his approach to learning seems to just grow within those students. That philosophy is there, and it has been held on to. Montessori, similarly, I would be looking at her work as well. So I think that we very often, in this modern world, lose those philosophers around education very easily, and I like to look back on them.
And Katrina, I'm going to stay with you for the final question, begin with you. What from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education?
You'll laugh at this one, the teacher's strike.
Okay, say more.
The school that we went to, we would say, was a very educational school. We did everything bar worry about exams. We had social events, we had film societies, we had a teacher who would take us off to the films that were a bit risque in those days, maybe not nowadays, and we'd come back and have discussions on them. We had charity events that we would go to orphanages and children's centres and work there. So at least once a week we were involved in some social event, as well as in plays and debates and the normal quizzes that schools would get involved in. So I think that kind of gave us confidence, as Mary said, in our own abilities to do things outside a school setting. It was a teacher's strike the year we were doing our junior cert, and there was a problem again the year we did our leaving cert. So you can count that I'm nearly 50 years out of the secondary school level at this stage. And the students came together and we set up our own little group in a little hall we hired out, and we worked together. Oh, we studied for as long as the strike went on for, yeah, and we're still friends.
And did you help each other?
Yes, yeah. Those who were good at maths did the maths with us, and those who were good at English helped us out with that. Well, it was a great morning. We used to work in the mornings and after lunch for a while, and then go home for the evening.
How long did the strike last for, do you remember?
I'd have to go back and look at the newspapers to find out.
Okay.
Okay. It was weeks, yeah, or longer.
Bernie, what from your primary or post-primary education informs or informed your practice in education?
I have to say there are very few positive things that had informed my, because in my day everything was rote learning, you know, and that bored me to tears, you know. I just hated this having to learn things off. But that said, I loved poetry, and all the poems that we learned off, like, they are still with me. I still remember all the poems that I learned, you know, and I love to be able to think back on those. But I suppose when I began teaching myself, then, you know, the rote learning, I suppose in the beginning I did use a bit of that myself, because as they say, you do teach the way you were taught. But then I realised very quickly, you know, that that wasn't a very democratic approach or a very liberating approach, you know, and began to question that, whether this was the right approach or not. And also, this is diverting a bit now from what you said, diverging a bit from it, but you said... When I was teaching first, I think when we came out of the training college and started teaching, we thought that we knew everything, that we had learned everything there was to be learned about teaching, that there was nothing more to be learned. And we were the ones now that knew it all. Our job was to teach, not to learn. And like that stayed with me for a good while. It took a while before it began to dawn on me, well, you know, you don't know everything. You can still learn more. And that really turned my life around, you know, that I when I began to see myself as a learner and not just as a teacher.
Mary, what from your primary or post-primary education informs or informed your practice?
The kindness of my junior infant teacher. I turned 4 in December, and so I was starting school straight after Christmas barely four, and my junior infant teacher was a nun, and she was so kind that I fell in love with her. And when the class moved on, it was called Halfpenny class, the junior infant class in those days. So when the class moved on to Penny, which was senior infants, I refused to go, and I was left there. I was left there for another year, so I did a year and a half at Halfpenny, and I never did Penny. I went into first class. So that kindness, that empathy, you know, you hear so many stories about the institutions and the nuns and everything. They were so kind. There was a teacher up further in the, and again another nun, who indulged my love of writing. I would write essays until the cows came home, 20, 30 pages, no trouble, and that lady corrected them all and told me I was wonderful, and I believed her. And then in post-primary, I remember a young teacher, and this was way before active learning was a thing, she was talking to us about glaciation, and she said, you know, I'm going to hire a bus and bring you all down to the burn. And she showed us the Clints and the Greggs, and we learned what glaciation was about, and I thought that was fantastic. She also brought us out, long before health and safety was an issue, on bikes on wet Saturdays to look at what was growing in fields around my town. So again, active learning, enthusiasm and kindness. That's what I bring from my primary and post-primary days.
Thanks, Mary. And finally, Maureen.
I suppose for me, when I think back, no more than Bernie, I think back on learning things by rote, which I'm just not able to do at all, good nor bad. So for me, it was kind of difficult. Or at least lots of the stuff at school was hard, I suppose maybe to do with poetry and stuff, and even still I get panicky about poetry. But an inspirational teacher I had was in second, when I went into second level, we had this teacher, an English teacher, who was kind of exotic because he came from England in the first place, and he looked a little bit like Leo Sayer, who was terribly cool at the time. And I remember on Wednesdays he would allow us, he broke the class up into groups, and he said, right, pick a story from the short story book and do a drama on it. And he gave us like Wednesday mornings, like for weeks on end to get together. So first of all, we'd have to pick the story, then decide, you know, what actual dialogue was going to be used, how it was going to be done. I just loved it. And I so admired him. And he actually went on to become a president of a college of education, subsequently the same man. But he was a fantastic teacher and inspirational for me.
And that enigmatic memory from secondary school came from Maureen Glenn, and it brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to Mary Roach, Maureen Glenn, Bernie Sullivan and Katrina McDonough from the Network of Educational Action Research in Ireland, and to Padraig Hogan from Maynooth University. I'll be back next week, but if you can't wait until then, you can find over 300 previous Inside Education podcasts at seandelaney.com/podcasts. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from good bookshops and online bookstores. From me, Sean Delaney, goodbye. Thank you for listening.